I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with a Deal, and today our guest is Sanjay Murthy, an M&A partner at Freshfields in New York. Sanjay, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, David. It's great to be here.
So we're going to talk about your career path on today's podcast, your years as an associate, a couple of key deals in your development, your move to Freshfields last year, the PowerSchool deal that you worked on last year that raised some interesting issues under Delaware law, and then finally, how you decompress from the job. So first of all, talk a little bit about yourself and how you came to the practice of law.
Yeah, happy to do that, David. I'm originally a Jersey guy. I grew up in Central Jersey. My parents had both emigrated from India. My dad, when he was very young, and my mom in her 20s, they both professionally were in the tech world. Growing up, my dad worked at AT&T Bell Labs and then Lucent during the rise of the PC and internet era. My mom, in between raising my brother and me, had worked at startups in a similar space. And so when I was young, my main frame of reference for what it really meant to be an adult in the workforce was the tech world. And as a result, and you know, having listened to the pod, I think this is a pretty common refrain among lawyers. But as a result, I really didn't grow up thinking about law as a career path. I just didn't have all that much visibility into what it was that lawyers actually did, especially not big law or corporate attorneys. To the extent that I had any conception of lawyering at all, it would have been litigators and courtrooms. And so early on, I'm not sure I had any strong career desires, law or otherwise. Given my background, I think tech would have seemed a natural path, and I was interested in it. But as a kid, I think I saw how hard my parents were working. And if anything, I was probably a little bit disinclined to follow in their footsteps. So getting through high school and thinking about college, I don't want to say I was totally aimless, but I would say, in maybe a little bit more of a media-friendly way, I was open to various paths and opportunities. Maybe the only thing I did know about going to college was I really wanted to get out of rural New Jersey. And so I think I applied to every college I could think of in a major city on the East Coast. I ended up getting into and going to Georgetown, but without really a clear mindset of what I was going to do when I got there. So between moving to DC, I had a vague interest in government and politics that I presumably had cultivated from watching The West Wing. I decided to major in something called political economy. I didn't know much about it, but candidly, I think it appealed to me in part because it was sort of this hybrid major between the government department and the business school. And I felt like I was keeping my options open a little bit. And so I got to Georgetown. I was studying government. I was studying economics. But as part of any real good liberal arts education, they make you take a couple of science courses. And given my background, I thought computer science would be a pretty painless way to knock off those credit requirements. And so I ended up taking a couple of computer science courses. And I think really to my surprise, I ended up really liking it.
What did you like about it?
I really love the problem solving aspect of computer science, the algorithmic way of thinking through things, the things that you could build, right? This was also in the era where Facebook was taking off. The iPhone was coming out. So it was a really exciting time.
The iPhone comes out in 2008. So you're about a sophomore in college at that point. And that was obviously a seismic event in the history of tech.
Absolutely. And to be around computer science and be thinking about the development of the app ecosystem and all of that throughout my time in undergrad, it was a really exciting time to be in tech. And so that was really the first time I thought maybe I had found a career path that I might take. And I really dove into computer science. I ended up adding computer science as a double major. I started a web design company. I was tinkering with some really bad startup ideas. And before I knew it, it was summer of my junior year, and I was quickly at a decision point for me. I spent the summer my junior year at Google. I interned at Google, and it was really a great experience in all the ways you'd expect getting to spend a summer on Google's campus in 2008 or 2009 would be. I got to work with really talented people. I went to these town halls where Larry and Sergey would talk about all these really cool things that Googlers were building. There were napping pods and ball pits and volleyball courts and bacon fried rice. And I was pretty close to accepting an offer to return to Google when I graduated. But ultimately, I think that summer also crystallized for me that programming wasn't really what I wanted to do long term or as a career. I think I really liked the academic and intellectual aspects of it, but I ultimately just couldn't shake this vision in my head that I'd seen play out a little bit over the summer of just coding away in a dark room with your headphones on, you know, hopped up on Red Bull. And so that was a part of me that I didn't want to continue to develop. And if I'm being fully candid here, I also looked around and I saw the people around me in the industry were both much more talented than I was and also much more interested and dedicated in the field than I was. And I think I had luckily enough self-awareness from that to realize that I wasn't going to be the next Mark Zuckerberg and maybe this wasn't the right path for me.
And so you did what many people do in that situation, which is you applied to law school.
Exactly. Just like any other 21-year-old with no clear career ambition, right? So I naturally thought, let's go to law school. I don't remember exactly what drove it, but I had been studying both politics and computer science for 4 years. And I think I thought maybe I'd find my way into something tech public policy related. And law school, it seemed like a reasonable next step for that, right? And so I ended up taking the LSAT and going to Columbia. And thankfully for me, it really felt close to immediately that I had made the right decision. It's not that I recall being incredibly excited about CivPro or legal writing or case law from the 1800s, but there were definitely courses and professors and peers that I found both incredibly interesting and thoughtful. And I was also really compelled by this idea that you could learn to think like a lawyer, which was like the mantra at Columbia. And it really reminded me a lot of what I liked about computer science. It was the finding issues, the problem solving, the thinking critically, the being creative. And so I really did enjoy that aspect of it. But as a first year law student, I didn't really know much about what life would look like after law school. I still didn't know much of anything about big law. I had a couple of touch points. One of my friends from college was starting as a first year at Cravath. And so I'd heard of Cravath. A college roommate of mine's father was a partner at Ropes. And so I'd heard of Ropes and Gray. And then everyone at Columbia would always talk about trying to find a job in big law when they graduated. And so that's really all I knew about big law or about life after school. And so as I was thinking about what I wanted to try to do my first summer, my friend who was at Cravath said, we hire a couple of 1Ls every year. You should maybe think about putting your name in. And more on a lark than anything, I did. I applied to the two firms I'd ever heard of. I applied to Cravath and I applied to Ropes. And I got an interview at Cravath. And in those days, this Cravath interview was this really storied thing. You know, legend had it, you'd have to go in at 9 a.m. and you'd leave at 5 and they'd run you through this gauntlet of interviews. And if you were successful, you'd get an offer on the spot. And if you were bumbled, they'd throw you out. And I went into this day of interviews, I think both extremely overprepared, but also not knowing anything. It was just this weird hybrid of emotions into that day. And I remember the first interview I had, the partner asked me something along the lines of, what do you want to do after law school? Or maybe it was, what's your 5-year plan after law school? And I was really naive and naive enough to try to answer that question honestly. I remember saying something like, well, I don't plan on being in big law for more than a couple of years. And in retrospect, probably should have just been kicked out of the office right there. But to his credit, the partner who I ended up getting to know really well when I started working at Cravath, he just smiled at me and said, great, you should treat Cravath or any other big law firm as a grad school. Big law is really the best place in the world to learn how to be an effective lawyer. And so come, do a couple of years, get the education out of it. And if you like it, stay. And if you don't, leave, and you can become our client. And that mantra really clicked for me. I really liked that mindset. It's one that I think I carried with me throughout my time as an associate, right? Whenever I would think about whether I wanted to stay in big law or try something new, I'd always ask myself, do you feel like you're still getting an education out of being here? And the answer was always yes. And so I always felt like I was learning and developing and growing. And so the couple year plan I had in my head of big law and then something else turned into almost a decade at Cravath.
So a couple of questions. One, your own experience as a law student interviewing, how does that affect how you interview law students? Because it seems to me as an interview, you always want to get the person out of the canned speech they're trying to give you, because that's when you really learn what the person is thinking. So how do you think about just interviewing law students?
Yeah, I think about it all the time. I sit on our recruiting committee here at the firm. And so I talk to summer or potential summer associates all the time. And you're right. They all start with the canned speech. But even in the canned speech, you can sometimes discern the people who are thinking about why they are here and what they want out of the interview and what they want out of the career that can be helpful. But yes, you do like to throw them off their game a little bit. I try to find out from them in very much the same way we're having this conversation, what drove them to this career point. And then I like to hear what they want to ask me, right? Because I often find that the people that are able to articulate the questions that will actually get them answers about the firm that they're going to potentially come to, or about the career, or about the job, are often the people that have that critical thinking skill in terms of what do I actually need to do to make the right decision and make sure that my judgment is correct. And so I do really pay attention to what people ask me. And then also, having been that student who didn't know anything, I do try to offer a little bit of advice here and there. I often get asked, what is the trait that makes a really successful associate? And I tell them it's not really about any individual specific skill that you have or that you can learn in law school. It's about coming to the job with the mindset that you're building a career and that this is a real opportunity for them to learn how to be a really good lawyer. And if you come with that mindset, you will have a level of proactivity and you won't look at this as a job or something being put upon you. You'll look at it as a really great window into professional development. And that's how I think about what the best associates are. It's the people that come in and say, you know, I'm here to put my head down and do all this work, not because it's a job and a payday, but because it's going to help me grow. And so I try to find people when I'm hiring that embody that feeling and that perception. And so it's not a science, it's an art, but that's kind of what I look for and what I talk to associates about.
And then if you think about being an associate at a law firm is going to graduate school, well, does becoming partner mean you've graduated from graduate school? Or what happens to that analogy as you move on in your career?
I don't think you ever graduate from grad school. No, I think this job is one of constant learning. And I think it's a function of the M&A practice, right? It is such a diverse practice. It covers so much ground, from acquisitions to spinoffs to joint ventures to governance to activist defense, right? There's just so much in the realm of what I do in my practice that I never really have felt like you stop learning, right? Every day, it's a new industry. It's a new transaction type. It's a new skill. And over the course of your career, your role changes too, right? And so maybe grad school shouldn't be 20, 30 years long, but I think in a profession like this, you're constantly learning and you're constantly growing. And so I'm not sure the analogy ever ends. I think it probably does, just because you can't be in school forever. But it does feel to me like big law is a place where you do just continue to learn and grow.
Ben, talk about how you found your way into M&A as a practice. A couple of key transactions for you as an associate.
So M&A it's what I did my first summer. It was my first experience in what it meant to be a corporate lawyer. And this was at a time where I was still having to Google what a corporation was. But even in that first summer, I got to see so much of what it is that I really enjoy about the practice today. It's the energy, the pace, the variety of the work, the complicated questions, and the nuanced answers. You know, I remember as a summer, just getting to sit in on meetings with clients and negotiations and watching associates and partners just brainstorm and advise. And I would say and contribute very little or close to nothing. But every time I was able to add even a tiny bit of value that made its way into the papers or come up with an argument that a partner ended up making, that was really exciting for me. And it was really the first time that I'd ever been in a setting like that. And so I think I just naturally, after that, had a soft spot in my heart for M&A. But, you know, I did try a lot of things. I spent time in capital markets. I spent time in restructuring. I spent time in financing. But just for whatever reason, it always felt to me that M&A was what I gravitated towards. And so maybe more a product of human nature than anything, but because it was something that I felt this emotional connection to, something that I was interested in, I think I probably applied myself more to it. I probably leaned in a little harder on the M&A deals I would get. I probably sought out that work a little more. And that probably snowballed on itself a little bit. And so even though Cravath ostensibly had this rotation system, I probably spent 5 or so of my 7 years working on M&A projects. And, you know, in retrospect, I think maybe the main reason I was so drawn to M&A is it always felt to me like the practice where you could truly have a role as an advisor, as a counselor to your clients. The M&A partners I knew were often the ones getting calls from clients with random questions, being asked to offer advice, not just on the deal, but on any sort of critical legal or commercial issue that would come up. And I think that's just the nature of the M&A practice. You cover so much ground that you're trained to think quickly and commercially about new issues. And so you can really set yourself up to be a true partner to your clients and really provide guidance. And that was the part of the job that I really enjoyed. And then you asked about deals. It's really hard to pick out any one deal that was critical. So much of my development as a lawyer was just getting reps and getting to see new things. And it's this accretion of rep after rep over time that leads to growth. But the sort of moments and transactions that always stand out in my mind that were formative for me were those where I got to spend in-person, on-location time with clients and with senior lawyers in those types of settings, right? And I think the main one that comes to mind is the J&J Actelion deal, which would have been back in 2016 or 2017. And so I was a very junior lawyer, and it was a very complex transaction. We were representing J&J, and they were trying to acquire a Swiss public company. And as part of that deal, we'd also negotiated that we'd spin off to Actelion's shareholders all of the early stage and pipeline assets of the company. And so it's a cross-border deal. There's a ton of work streams, a ton of interacting rules, the Swiss takeover code, the US securities laws, the listing rules of the Swiss stock exchange. And a big part of my job at the time was really just trying to keep track of everything that was happening. And I learned a lot from the day-to-day work that I was doing on that deal, but it was also one of those deals that both sides clearly viewed as the top priority at the time. And so as we got towards the end, it became a matter of, let's get everybody into the room to hash this thing out. And so we flew to Switzerland once and got to spend a ton of time with the client. I learned a lot about relationship building there. I saw how senior partners interacted with the client. I saw the importance of building an interpersonal connection, not just because it's all about trying to get the next deal, but because getting to know your clients well and building that sense of partnership really led to better outcomes and made the job more enjoyable. I remember towards the end of the deal, we hunkered down for days in Wachtell's offices, and it was really a great and close to my first opportunity for me to really see in person what truly high level lawyering looked like. It was quick, on your feet, problem solving with the CEOs in the room, the side conversation with the client that leads to an idea that turns an issue into a win for both parties, the abandonment of ego and hierarchy in service of getting the deal done. This may be a bit of an apocryphal story, and I think I would have been on like very little sleep, and so I may have hallucinated some of this, but I do have this memory on that transaction. It must have been in the last 12 hours or so of the deal. I was taking dictated comments to the merger agreement from a partner, and my laptop just died mid-sentence. And as a really junior lawyer, I was, of course, just completely panicking. You know, I was the one running the document on our side. And so I was trying to find a cord or plug it in or do something with the computer. And I remember the partner on the deal just looked at me, saw how flustered I was and how much I was struggling, and then just walked across the hallway to where the Wachtell team was and commandeered a laptop from one of the Wachtell associates and just began plugging in the comments to the document himself. And so that for me was a lesson in how to be calm under pressure when things go wrong and how to just do whatever it takes to get the deal done.
And so talk about, you know, what it's like maybe the last year before you become a partner or chosen to be a partner, just which almost every partner says is a really, you know, one of the most stressful times in their professional lives. How do you manage that? And what was your experience of that year like?
Well, unluckily for me, it was the year of the pandemic and also the year of the big M&A boom, right? And so we were around the clock sprinting through transactions and deals. And for a long period of time, just doing that out of my apartment, my one bedroom apartment in the West Village. And so it was a struggle. It was a challenge. I think the nice thing about it was I had a sense of timeline. And so I knew there was 1 year to go. And so I was able to put my head down and sprint through the finish line. But it was incredibly challenging because I lost a lot of the things that made the job so enjoyable, the in-person interactions, the sort of camaraderie of being around the office. And so it was a very challenging year of being stuck at home and waking up every morning at 7 a.m., working, going to bed at 3 a.m. and restarting all over again. But I had the benefit of having my now wife, my then girlfriend, was living with me. So we were able to find time to decompress. And at some point, I moved to live in the suburbs with my family, and we got a dog. And so that helped to de-stress things a little bit. And it was a good learning experience. And I will tell you, there's no better way to accelerate the progression of your skill set than working nonstop for 365 days. And I think it did set me up to be a much better attorney now than if I hadn't gone through that experience. And so I like to look at it in a positive light, even though it was a really, really stressful time in my life.
Talk about your move to Freshfields.
It was an incredibly, incredibly difficult decision. I love Cravath. I think some of my closest friends to this day are Cravath partners. I met my wife there. And so it was a really agonizing decision, and probably one that has more factors than I could articulate in just a few minutes. But I think a big part of the impetus for it for me was I had spent so much time in the early part of my career thinking in just 1 or 2 year increments, really just answering that question of, do I feel like I'm learning? And so I had never really given a ton of thought to the long term. And so when I made partner, it was this culminating moment, but it was also really the first time that I sat down and said, this is going to be the next 30 years of your career. What does that look like? And what do you actually want out of it? And so piecing through it all, as I was thinking through it, I thought about how much the industry has changed in the last 10, 15 years, right? There was an era not so long ago where you could really count on one hand the firms that were competing for top tier M&A work. And I was looking at firms like Freshfields, like Paul Weiss, like Kirkland, who were skyrocketing up the M&A league tables, and thinking, what are those firms doing now? And what does that change look like over the next 5 years and over the next 30 years? And to me, it became clear that there's just this tremendous amount of disruption happening in the industry. And really at the center of that are firms that have been quicker to adapt to what clients' needs are, right? Our clients' businesses are becoming increasingly complex, increasingly global, increasingly regulated. And it seemed to me that the firms that are ultimately going to be successful in the long run are the ones that are going to be able to put together really top-tier teams, not just across the key practice areas that clients are focused on, but also across jurisdictions. And so what excited me about Freshfields is that they'd already done that in London, they'd already done that in Germany and in Asia, and they had started to become really successful in doing that here in the US in M&A and antitrust and in dispute resolution. And so it felt like a place that was really setting itself up to be one of the elite players in the industry, not just today, but well into the future. And so that was the sort of business rationale in my mind. But obviously, there's also a personal element to it. And I thought about how I wanted to spend my time. And there was always a part of me that had this entrepreneurial mindset that when I was young, wanted to be in the startup world. If I wasn't such a risk-averse lawyer. And, you know, not that Freshfields is anything close to a startup, but it is a firm that is quickly adapting and evolving, whether it's in all the growth we're seeing in the US or figuring out ways to leverage AI or developing new training programs. It just really felt like a place where I would have the opportunity to influence the future of the business and help build and grow the parts of the firm here in the US that we're still developing. And that was really appealing to me. And so now that I'm here, we've got the successful and growing franchise in the US. I really feel like I've been able to contribute to making sure that we are building something here that is sustainable. I sit on the talent development committee. I sit on the recruiting committee, like I said. And, you know, we're constantly working together as partners to ensure we're attracting top tier talent and also creating an environment in this new sort of post-pandemic era where that talent can develop and grow and excel. And it's been really rewarding for me to get to impact the shape of the business in a way that I think really may only be possible at a place like this.
Switching gears, talk a little bit about the PowerSchool transaction you worked on last year, which raised issues related to controlling shareholders under Delaware law.
Yeah, and David, I know you had a great article about this deal, and so maybe I'll point your listeners to that for all of the full background. But you know, for our conversation, I'll just say PowerSchool was a sponsor-backed public company looking at a sale. Their existing sponsor stockholders were both potentially rolling over their equity and also in a deal potentially going to be entitled to receive a pretty sizable payment under a tax receivable agreement. And so you have this potentially conflicted transaction, and we at Freshfields were advising the special committee to the board on evaluating that transaction. Is it the right deal to do for the public shareholders? And also negotiating pretty aggressively to ensure that if there was a deal to be done, we were going to maximize the value payable to the public, including if that meant coming at the expense of the existing sponsors. And for me, it's a deal that really stands out this year for a couple of reasons, right? Obviously, for the nerd in me, it raised some really interesting issues that are at the forefront of Delaware jurisprudence right now in terms of just the increased scrutiny on controlling shareholder and conflicted transactions, right? There's always been scrutiny on these types of deals, but the judicial skepticism of controllers and the influence they have has really only grown. And I think that'll continue to be a trend that we see in 25. So there's only going to be more and more emphasis on than ever on running effective processes, which I think we were able to do really effectively in PowerSchool. But the deal also stands out for me because it's the type of deal and type of work that I find particularly fulfilling in this job, right? Like it's the advisory and counseling piece of the job. It's getting to work with incredibly smart and dedicated board members who know they're going to be in the spotlight on this and being able to guide them through complex and often novel issues in a clear and concise way and really give them the roadmap to being effective advocates for the public. And it's a challenging part of the job, and it's not always easy. But when I think about the types of transactions where having a good M&A advisor is particularly critical, it's these types of deals. And so it was a really great and interesting deal for me to get to work on. And it was also just a great affirmation for me that I'd made the right choice in joining the team at Freshfields.
And then finally, you talked a little bit about this earlier. Talk about how you decompress from the job.
Yeah. Finding ways to decompress is an incredibly critical part of the job, right? It's a client services business. And so there's obviously going to be times where you have to be running at full speed. And there's times where running at full speed means running a marathon at full speed. But I just try to be intentional with the time away from the job in the same way that I'm intentional about the time in the job. So I believe in taking vacations, and I've been really blessed with having partners that will carry the load for me when I do that. And I do the same for them when they're out. On an everyday basis, unless I'm, you know, at a work dinner, my wife and I will sit down and have dinner together every night, away from the computer and sometimes even away from my phone. In terms of like bigger events, I'm a huge Knicks fan. I've also managed to brainwash my wife into also being a Knicks fan. And so we try to get to about 10 or 15 games at the Garden every year. We often just try to use it as an opportunity to convince a friend or two to come with us and catch up with people we haven't seen. And then these days, we're also reading a lot of baby books. We're expecting our first kid in June. And so I think maybe if you come back to me in 6 months or so and ask me how I'm managing my time then, I may have a pretty different answer for you.
Sanjay, thank you so much for joining us.
Always great talking to you, David. Appreciate it.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.